Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Now, Larry Mueller here with me on the phone, Mr. 4th of July himself, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Scott, hi.
Good morning, Larry, and happy 4th of July to you and everyone else.
How are you planning to celebrate today?
Well, I'm planning on spending the next 90 minutes with your listening audience talking about wildlife. Then I'm going to promptly go down and jump into the beautiful, clear waters of Lake Tomahawk, and then probably take a nap.
Sounds like a great...
And then tonight I'm going to take the boat into Lake Minocqua and watch the fireworks in Minocqua. So should be great.
Should be a lot of fun, and I guess we had a lot to talk about today.
Well, there's lots going on. Lots of news about bald eagles and them coming off the protection of the Endangered Species Act. There's deer information coming out already for the pending fall hunting season, record turkey harvest, all sorts of things going on as far as wildlife is concerned. It's a great time of year.
It sure is. And let's give the number here for people to join in. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890. Give a call. And guess what? We have some callers online already, so let's go to the phones. Joe in Oshkosh, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's something happened in the woods about 15 years ago that kind of haunts me still today. It was in Washera County when I was trout fishing in the Pine River. And I was by myself, and I was back there. And all of a sudden, when I started moving upstream, I heard this really strong cat sound, like a cat, like a big cat.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't figure it out, and I stopped, and I was actually a little scared. And then when I stopped, it would stop, and then about three times each time I'd move, it would growl at me. And then I looked, and I saw this kind of a black flash back in the brush, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know what it was. Have you any idea what that could be?
Sure.
I know you don't like these kind of questions.
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, animals can make a variety of strange sounds, and we've had something that people might interpret as being, oh, it had to be something like this, might be something as simple as a young animal of some other species that's just begging for food. So sounds are kind of tricky, and, you know, sightings, especially a quick glimpse of something, is pretty difficult to interpret. Considering that it was quite a long time ago, the rash of cougar sightings and so forth that we've had over probably more like the last 5, 6, 7 years that suggest that these animals are present, although their origins remain unclear. This is back a little before that time. I guess, Joe, the short answer, I wish I could clear this up since you prefaced this by saying it's haunted you for years, but... You know, that's not very much to go on, and any kind of definitive answer is going to continue to elude us. But
okay,
could have been a bobcat, maybe.
You know, a bobcat's a possibility, but there are other animals that can make cat-like sounds. You know, I just remember, and we've talked about this before, Larry, with the young barred owls that I tracked down one day. They were making a sound that I thought. I interpreted it as someone being tortured in the woods. There was so much screaming and hollering and yelping and so forth that did sound very much cat-like. So there are a number of possible, too many possible explanations to really pin something like that down for you.
All right.
In the absence of a track or something else that we could sort out, big and black, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is a bear, but their sounds, they generally don't make the sounds that you describe. So, bottom line, Joe, I don't know.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. You're going to have to be, you're going to have to continue to be
haunted
by this. One of the things you could do is go online and take, there are several places that have online sounds that you can listen to, like one sound of a bobcat or a bear or whatever, and maybe do a little, just for fun, do a little searching around sound-wise that way. Might be worth, it's fun anyway to do that. I've done it myself a few times, and it is a lot of fun to do.
Worth a try.
Worth a try. Thanks, Joe. Cindy in Glidden, hi.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have heard this ridiculous rumor, and I was just wondering if Scott could clear it up for me. I heard that the DNR is introducing rattlesnakes from Texas.
To control turkeys.
To control turkeys.
Well, now, you might have gathered that we've heard this one before.
You have. Well, okay. Could you please set us straight?
Your description of that rumor as ridiculous is right on.
Okay.
I couldn't have described it more aptly myself. There is no effort to move snakes of any kind, let alone Texas rattlesnakes, which probably wouldn't do well here.
Well, of course they wouldn't. And these people swear that they've talked to DNR representatives right after the fact, after they've introduced them, and I just couldn't believe it.
most of the times I've heard that story, for some reason it seems to be associated with Door County, but apparently it's more widely spread than that. But
Park Falls area.
Yeah, there's no reason or need for controlling wild turkeys, nor any program online to do that right now. And secondly, rattlesnakes would be a poor choice. I don't know what they would do by way of turkey control. And
the whole thing is just ridiculous. Yes.
Raccoons would do a lot better job on the eggs, and we already have plenty of raccoons.
And we have plenty of raccoons, and yet the turkey population continues to expand.
That's right.
And, you know, as we alluded to early on, hunters set a new harvest record this past spring with over 50,000 turkeys taken. So forget about the rattlesnake issue. That's not going to happen. It's absolutely bogus.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for listening to me.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Cindy. You wonder how those things get started.
Mark, once they do, they take on a life of their own.
Yeah, they sure do. Mark in Colfax, your turn now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I have a rather large shed that I process deer in, and I've got at least one family of red squirrels that have moved into my ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Concerned that, you know, wiring and things are going to start going next. And the shed is large enough I'd have a real hard time trying to devise some way of keeping them out. I'm afraid my only option left is to trap them.
Mm-hmm.
How would I go about doing that?
Well, I guess, Mark, the first line of defense when an animal's in a building, if they're not in there by accident, and I had a red squirrel in my office here yesterday, and it took me 20 minutes to chase him out the open door, but if they're in there and they've taken up residence, obviously they have an access. If you truly feel there's no way you can prevent access, either there's too big an open ridge vent or whatever, if there's no way you can prevent access, then you're right. Probably the only thing you can do is catch and remove them. It's going to be up to you in a setting like that, whether you do that with a live trap where you catch them alive and move them out, or whether you use a trap that, in fact, like a rat trap, that's going to kill them. That's your choice. I guess the squirrels are in there because they thought it was a good spot to raise a family, so I guess I'd urge you to try the live trap approach first, but knowing full well that use of a simple and inexpensive rat trap is going to be a whole lot easier for you in the long run. But I think if you can remove them first, that's the best approach. But in general, whether it's a house or a shed or any other building, when any animal, be it squirrel, coon, or anything else, gets in, the issue is access, and the true solution over the long term is to find that access and eliminate it. So,
I'm a little concerned about live trap because I'm going to trap it and move it for somebody else's problem.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah, and if I were to use a rat trap, what do you use to bait?
On a mouse size or a rat size snap trap, when you're dealing with chipmunks, ground squirrels, red squirrels, mice, rats, or whatever, you can't beat peanut butter.
Okay.
But when it's warm like this, the peanut butter gets soft and runny, and especially small animals will be able to lick the peanut butter right off the trigger and not get caught. So the thing to do is take a little tiny square of some type of material or cloth or fabric, you know, no more than an inch square at best, and tightly wrap that around the trigger and tie it off or wire it off so it essentially creates a cloth-covered trigger. And then when you smear the peanut butter into that, it holds it much better to the trigger, and the animal in question has to tug on it a little bit to get that last little bit of peanut butter, and that's the end of the line.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Mara, and while Pat, oh, wait, I'm sorry. Pat in East Troy, I believe, is next. Pat, hi, sorry. Pat, are you there? Well, maybe I was right to go to Mara. Mara, hello in Waupaca.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I have a critter in my yard that is digging holes that are 3 to 4 inches across, and they tunnel to about anywhere from 10 to 20 feet away, and then they come up the other end. Any idea what that might be and how I might get rid of it?
So there's actually a tunnel. So there's an opening, and then apparently an underground tunnel, and then another opening that you think they've either got left from or gone from or whatever.
Right. One of the holes always has a mound of dirt around it, and one of them doesn't.
Well, 3 or 4 inch hole like that is a little large for it. So the hole itself is 3 or 4 inches in diameter?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's maybe a little large for ground squirrels. The first thing that comes to mind would be ground squirrels, but you never see any animal around.
No.
It's not really big enough for a woodchuck or other burrowing animal of that size, and it's a little large for ground squirrels, but that's a possibility. Chipmunks, ground squirrels, I think the only way you're going to figure it out for sure is to actually, near where they're digging, set some sort of a trap, and in this case, a live trap would probably work, baited with something universal like the peanut butter we were just talking about or a scoop of sunflower seeds, and see what you catch. That's not the typical work of the kinds of animals that normally spend a lot of time underground, like a pocket gopher, which you shouldn't have in Waupaca anyway, or a mole, which rarely leaves an open hole like that. So,
I'm in Waupaca, but I live in Madison.
Oh, so you're talking about Madison?
Right.
Okay, well, then that really doesn't change much. We
no.
still don't have pocket gophers in Madison, and as I said, the moles would normally... I see an occasional open hole in my own trails in Dane County where the moles have gone in, but they're very discreet about the soil mounds you usually see don't have an opening associated with them. They push the soil up from beneath. So it doesn't sound like mole. It's not pocket gopher. I'm still thinking ground squirrel is the likely culprit, but if you don't see them out, set a trap near the holes and see what you catch, and then you'll know what you're up against. Are there a lot of these holes?
I've had about 6 to 8 of them now.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, that's certainly, ground squirrels can be abundant enough to do that, but they're usually out and active during the day when they're fairly visible. If the holes had been kind of a blind pouch or just went down a few inches, then that's usually the work of skunks or raccoons digging up soil grubs at night. But that doesn't seem to be what you described. So I'm still thinking ground squirrels.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Amar. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer on this 4th of July on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Let's go to Pat in East Troy next. Pat, hello. We're still not hearing.
Uh-oh, we're still not hearing from Pat.
I don't know what's wrong with Pat. Pat's phone must have died. Ruth in Washera County. Hi, Ruth.
Good morning, Larry. Happy 4th of July. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know how unusual it is to see a pair of sandhill cranes with 3 babies. Because we've also heard the talk that when the first one hatches, to protect from predators, they usually leave the nest. You know, that's why a lot of times you see only 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
But how unusual is that to see 3?
3 is certainly on the upper extreme. 1 or 2, much more common, but I suppose it's possible. Particularly good fortune for that pair. It's also possible that if there were several pairs in the area with some larger birds, some waterfowl species, an older, more experienced pair may actually usurp the young of a younger, less experienced pair, or if the chick happened to be orphaned for whatever reason. So it's a possibility that that's a natural occurrence from one nest. It's probably also possible that it's an amalgamation of two broods.
Well, we've been watching them for a good 3 weeks now, watching them grow and trottle through the field. And a
lot of fun, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Well, good. It's a neat observation, no matter what its cause.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you.
Bob in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Happy 4th of July.
To you as well.
Scott, I when I go fishing, I go up to Rhinelander. My son is Dr. Aylesworth in Rhinelander, and he owns a cabin on Lake Columbus. Do you know where that is? In between Sugar Camp and Eagle River, small lake.
I know the area, yep.
And then another little lake, Long Lake, it's just down the road about a half a mile, and he's got a little cabin on each of those.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was wondering, the last few years, the walleyes, especially in Lake Columbus, they have to be 15 inches long for legal length. Is that still in place?
The walleye regulations vary a great deal from lake to lake for a couple reasons. Some lakes have been designated as a slot size limit, so you can keep any walleyes you catch less than 14 inches, but only one over 14 inches. Some lakes are only, like Lake Tomahawk that I'm on now, is only walleyes 15 inches and above. So, and then the bag limit varies from lake to lake depending on the Native American harvest, the spearing harvest in the spring. So there are lots of things going on with walleyes, but each lake has its own set of regulations specific.
Every one a little different, huh?
Well, not necessarily.
Not everyone, but
there are only a certain number of regulations you can set.
Yeah.
But each lake, the regulations that are imposed on each lake are based on several things, including the DNR survey results for the health and size and age distribution of the walleye population in the lake, and then also the tribal take in the spring and several other factors. So it really is unique to a certain degree to each lake.
Yeah. And another thing is that when I go up there fishing the last 2-3 years, I've noticed all kinds of juvenile eagles.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Well, that's an interesting segue into talking about the fact for just a moment that eagles are doing very, very well. It's kind of appropriate, I guess, to talk about the national bird on the 4th of July, but eagle nesting numbers now in the lower 48 states, and they're present in all of the lower 48 states, which is something of an accomplishment in itself, considering only 40 years ago they were on the verge of extinction. We're now over 10,000 nesting pairs in the lower 48 states. Wisconsin is number three by way of numbers of nesting eagles, and it's now become, whereas not too long ago it was something noteworthy to say, oh, I saw an eagle. Now if I'm out on the lakes here in the North Woods, if you don't see an eagle in about 10 or 15 minutes, gee, I wonder where the eagles are.
Yeah.
So they're actually doing very well. They're being removed from protection of the Endangered Species Act, but still will be protected under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And there's some details to be worked out on what levels of protection they'll have from disturbance and other types of things that might influence their populations. But the bottom line is that the eagle population is doing very well, and they've become a common sight.
Mm-hmm.
Really pleased me was I think most of the eagles that I've seen, especially on Lake Columbus and Long Lake too, but mainly Columbus, is that most of the ones that I see are juvenile, so I feel good about that.
Well, yeah. That's a good reflection of the fact that they're doing well.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, Bob was talking about walleye in the first part of his question, and, you know, it's a fish that people are much more likely to keep than a lot of other fish. You know, we have quite a catch and release on bass, and certainly on muskie, it's got to be 90% or better returned to the water. I'm throwing that number off the top of my head. I seem to remember that.
I think that's true, and it's a strange thing. And there's something about the image of a walleye that, boy, if you get a legal walleye, that's an accomplishment. And there's the perception is that it's the finest eating fish there is. So yeah. If you've got one, I think for the most part, unless it's a big trophy fish that might not eat very well, most people do take them. Bass, on the other hand, I was out on Lake Tomahawk last night and got onto a bar out in the middle of the lake in the rain last night, and the bass, the smallmouth bass, were just going crazy. I think I caught 6 or 7 legal fish and put every single one of them back.
Right.
In fact, I don't think I've ever killed a smallmouth bass on Lake Tomahawk, which may in its own right cause some problems for the walleyes because there's so many bass now. But anyway, that's correct.
Pat in East Troy has changed phones, Scott.
Okay, let's try it. Third time's the charm.
Let's see. Pat, hello.
Hi, Larry. I'm so sorry for all the trouble, and now my voice is giving out, so this just isn't my day. But I was very anxious to ask Scott what he could tell me about 3 flying squirrels that I found when I went to take in my squirrel-proof feeders. But the flying squirrels were not big enough to trip them, so they were having a good time. And I'm in southeastern Wisconsin, and I've been told by our family expert that you can't have flying squirrels this far south, or this far, this far north.
Actually, there are 2 species of flying squirrels in this state. Pat, the southern flying squirrel and the northern flying squirrel. The northern flying squirrel is a little bigger and considered to be an animal of kind of the northern part of the state, but the southern flying squirrel is extremely common virtually all over the state. If you look at a range map and a field guide, it will say that southern flying squirrels inhabit about the southern two-thirds or three-quarters of Wisconsin, but there are records of them now all the way up to the Lake Superior shoreline. And during our summer field camp here at Kemp Station in Minocqua, the students catch live trap lots of southern flying squirrels. So your family expert is just a little bit off in terms of their distribution, in that they're really quite a common animal, but not commonly seen. Because of all of our small mammals, they are probably the most strictly nocturnal. So unless you rig up a feeder that you can watch at night with a floodlight or occasionally flip on a flashlight or whatnot to see what's out there, there could be lots of them around and you'd never know it. But they're beautiful little animals. They're very attractive. They have huge dark eyes and very, very soft velvety fur and that big flat rudder-like tail and, of course, the membrane of skin that stretches from their foreleg to their hind leg that they can extend so they can glide. So bottom line is, they're fun to see, and it's nice to know they're around, and they are quite common.
It was probably the highlight of my summer.
But, oh, that's good.
I can't understand why they didn't come back. They were doing so well that one night, and I've been out doing the same rotation of the feeders, taking them in and putting them back, and they haven't been around.
Well, I think if you put an open platform feeder out with some sunflower seeds or nut meats on it and keep an eye on that at night, you'll see them again. If you live in a wooded area where they've got some tree cavities and whatnot to den in, I'm sure you'll see them again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's wonderful news. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat. I'm glad we finally got through to each other there at third try. Third try was a charm. Steve in Michicott, it's your turn. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. My question is about badgers. A few years ago, it was June or July. It was summer. I saw a badger. Don't know if it was a male or female. I think they're pretty similar in appearance, not necessarily size. But it was running through an area of a black spruce tamarack bog in Lincoln County Forest. You probably know where that is.
Yep.
It's like Harrison, town of Harrison, right? Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of unusual.
Well, it's unusual to see a badger in the first place. I've been in Wisconsin now for 35 years, and although I've seen road-killed badgers on the side of the road, and people occasionally bring in specimens that we use at the university, I've yet to see a live one. But they're distributed pretty much statewide, not common, but not rare or endangered by any means. Just not pretty darn secretive. So
yeah.
seeing a badger in the first place is a neat thing. Seeing one, the kind of boggy habitat surprises me a little bit.
Yeah, it threw me off.
They're more of an, you know, an upland dry country animal digging into hillsides and road cut banks and so forth, looking for ground squirrels and chipmunks and other food sources. But on the other hand, who knows what that badger was doing there? It could have been just going from point A to point B, and the bog happened to be in between. So
I see. It actually looked pretty content and healthy.
Well, yeah. It's one animal that, you know, whereas we have people call and say, well, I'm not sure what this was, with that black and white face and with, of course, the Bucky Badger mentality in Wisconsin, that's one animal that everybody's pretty darn certain about.
That's funny. Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Appreciate it. And Walt in West Madison, your turn. Hi, Walt.
Hello. I think I had squirrels in my attic last winter, but I think they've left for the season, and I imagine they'll come back. By what date should I have this access taken care of? I think I know where the access is.
Well, that's kind of tricky, Walt. I squirrels breed. Gray squirrels have two litters per year on average, one usually born early in the spring, and then those young squirrels are out on their own by June or so, and then they have another litter in the summer, and those young then are on their own by the start of fall. So it's if they're not using it as a den site, which would surprise me a little bit, they may not be in there now. If they are using it as a den site, you're either... Well, you'd be right about at the time of summer litter potentially being in there, so there's the risk of trapping them. However, there are one way, if you know what the access point is, and you can boil this down by treating any secondary openings or whatever else to basically one opening you're sure they're using, there are one-way excluders, little spring-loaded doors. One, for example, made by the Tomahawk Live Trap Company just down the road from me here in Tomahawk, Wisconsin, that can be stapled over the access point, and it allows the squirrels to leave but not get back in. That might be one, that kind of a temporary solution might give you some peace of mind that you're not going to trap them inside.
Okay, and do they eat the electrical cords?
They don't eat the electrical cords, but they will certainly chew on the cabling and chew the insulation off. Either because of the chemical taste or just because they're constantly chewing to keep their...
Is that a danger of fire?
It certainly is.
Sure.
I mean, there are many reasons why you don't want gray squirrels in your attic. The electrical cables are one. Damage or messing up the insulation is another. The physical chewing and gnawing and holes that they create, which lets other pests in, and a whole host of other things. Squirrels, if you shave the hair off the tail of a squirrel, you pretty much have a rat.
Yeah.
In terms of size, shape, behavior, and everything else. So I would never urge anyone to tolerate gray squirrels in their attic. They just have too much potential for damage.
Good luck, Walt. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He's on the line today from Tomahawk at the Kemp Research Station, and really pleased to have him with us by phone on this 4th of July. Jim in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
Well, first, I've lived in Wisconsin since 71, and I've been lucky enough to see three badgers, but that's not my question.
Well, I got here in 72, Jim, and I'm still looking for my first one, so you'll have to give me some pointers sometime.
It just happens to be luck. Okay. I'm right place at the right time. But anyways, in this area, and I believe it's true because the people have told me I trust, and they're wildlife. They're out hunting all the time. But we have a big cat, probably a cougar or something like that, in southwest Wisconsin towards the Mississippi, like in Genoa area.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, how would we end up with a cat like that down here?
Well, there's been much debate centered on the presence or absence of cougars or mountain lions or pumas, all the same animal, for as long as Larry and I have been doing this program.
Right.
It goes way back to just after the Civil War. But the fact of the matter is that cougars were native to Wisconsin and were lost from the state or extirpated back in the late 1800s. But they, of course, persist as a fairly common animal in western states and as close as the Dakotas and so on. And they're, as a large, very mobile animal, they're quite capable of covering the distance from, say, South Dakota to Wisconsin with no real difficulty. So it's quite possible that truly wild cougars might find their way into the state occasionally. In fact, there was one that had been, this was 3 or 4 years ago now, a cougar that South Dakota Fish and Game Department had radio collared with a transmitter, out in the Black Hills somewhere, and that animal was last tracked, as far as I know, somewhere in central Minnesota, headed our way. But in addition to the wild sources, there are, or at least in the past, were quite a few mountain lions held in captivity as exotic pets, or for whatever reason someone would want an animal like that, which escapes me personally, but nevertheless, there were a number of them held in captivity, and it's also quite possible that when those animals grow up from a cute little cub, and all of a sudden, oh, I can't handle this anymore, all of a sudden it's boom, out the back door, good luck and goodbye, or animals that legitimately escape. So there are a number of possible sources, but there's very little doubt anymore, Jim, that there are over a sizable chunk of Wisconsin, if not all of Wisconsin, the possibility that someone might encounter or see a cougar. And certainly there are sightings, and I've had, you know, people on the kind of on the QT say, well, we've got one here or there, and we just don't talk about it very much for one not wanting to attract attention. So whether it's Genoa or the northeastern part of the state or the southeastern part of the state, there are persistent accounts that these animals are out there.
Yeah. It's still surprising, and we've discussed it on the show in the past, that, you know, with a deer hunt where you've got, what, 600,000 people out running around in the woods with snow, we never see any tracks.
Well, that's correct. And these people, there are not many corners, as you know as a deer hunter, Larry. There aren't many corners of the state that don't have somebody in orange sitting there come deer season. So how these animals escape detection at that point is a mystery to me. But I've had enough accounts now over the years by people who should know that these animals are definitely out there.
Thanks, Jim. Roy in Hurley, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Roy.
Good morning, men.
Good morning.
There was a party just talking about squirrels in the attic.
Yes.
If you find the entrance to that place, and especially if it's one or more, but put ammoniated rags or ammonia in some form by that crack, and they'll never come back.
No.
Yes, ammonia is something along with naphthalene or moth flakes that are sometimes recommended as an odor that's very offensive. For example, if you've got them in your chimney flue and you put a little pan of ammonia or a rag or something in the firebox, close your glass doors and those fumes will drive them out of the flue so that you can put an animal-proof cap on the chimney. Same thing with the hole. The problem, of course, is if you seal the hole with anything, whether it's a repellent like ammonia or something else, you run the risk of trapping the animal inside.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things are best when the animal's already been removed, but it will keep them from returning.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Roy. Appreciate it. Paul in DeSoto, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I got a little bit of a problem here. I live on just outside of a bunch of woods, about 80 acres. And I got animals like you can't believe, all the way from deer to squirrels to rabbits to groundhogs to skunks to raccoons and mice and everything. And they're doing a number on my garden worse than a lawnmower would do, you know?
Yeah.
I'm about ready to move to a penthouse. But anyway, I also have a building on this place I very seldom go into. It's like a storage shed, but it's got a ceiling in. And one day I went in there, and doggone it, if I didn't look up, and the ceiling tile was coming down because it was all wet. And there's no water in that place. And I couldn't hardly believe it. So I went and looked up at the roof, and there's a hole in the roof. about 6 inches or 5 or 6 inches in diameter. And it was clearly chewed. It was, the shingles were chewed through, and the underlayment was chewed through. Now, what in the miserable kind of a blue blazes animal was that?
Well, especially on a building that's not used routinely, and if the roofing was at all compromised, you know, it was old, it was weak, there was some dry rot or anything else, then the most likely animal to make a hole that size directly in a roof surface is a raccoon. And they're a very powerful animal and can tear their way in. And I've seen lots of shed roofs and even homes where the raccoons will tear their way in like that. And then you get a variety of water problems. You get raccoon droppings in urine. You get the raccoons themselves. So that's probably the most likely culprit. But, again, that kind of a building that's providing harborage for the same animals that are likely causing problems for your garden, it's all part of the package. If you're going to live like you do and I do on the edge of town where there's abundant wildlife, you really need to develop some sense of tolerance and peaceful coexistence while at the same time using the necessary fencing around a garden and construction tactics on your buildings and decks and sheds and things like that, so that the animals, which are going to be there no matter what, don't cause you any severe aggravation or problems. Really no alternative.
Thank you so very much. I had no idea it could ever be a raccoon or whatever. I thought maybe it was a groundhog. I'm going to the penthouse.
Okay, good luck with that.
All right, Paul, thanks for calling. You know, Scott, this this summer, we, because of the construction and remodeling on our house, we've had essentially no squirrels or rabbits in our backyard, which is kind of nice because the flower beds look pretty good, all except the daylily bed that is right next to the lake. And it has been chewed off at about 6 inches height. And I told my wife I thought it was probably the muskrat that is, or one or two that are sort of in the area. Would a muskrat eat off daylilies, do you think?
Sure, I think they might.
I think they would.
I think they might, and the location along the shoreline suggests that that's probably the case, and they wouldn't be at all bothered by the construction noise and hubbub and whatnot as people are working on the building. Whereas I think your woodchuck problem and probably the rabbits have been held at bay by all that activity.
Yep. Bob in Montello, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Happy 4th of July, you guys.
To you as well.
Hey, I just got a question. We live, we've got a place, vacation place on Buffalo Lake in Montello.
Mm-hmm.
And great place to watch birds. Just tons of blue herons and kingfishers. But we were going around on the pontoon one afternoon, and I saw like about 12 birds that were about the size, a little bit smaller than the blue heron, but they were jet black, and they had bright orange sharp beaks.
Mm-hmm.
And was wondering, I'd never seen that type of bird before. I was wondering if you had any idea what type of bird that could be.
What were they doing? Were they behaving like a heron?
They were all perched in trees. There were like 12 of them sitting up in a tree, and they were right along the shoreline. And we've subsequently have seen them past this flying alongside the lake. But they are, I would say, a little bit smaller than a heron, but have a very tall, bent neck, very similar to that.
So they fly like a heron when you see them.
They
kind
actually
of a slow flapping and so forth. And they're always around the lake.
Yeah, always around the lake. Yep.
Well, I think since you mentioned them perching in trees like that and the heron-like shape and size and all, I think if you look in a bird book at green heron, that they are, in fact, herons. There are several types of herons, and most are much smaller than great blues. But green herons would appear very dark. They're called green, but I think when most people see them, they might describe them as really dark or even black. And they spend a lot of time in trees when they're not roaming around the lake shore probing for fish and frogs and things like that. So I think that's what you're seeing. And if you want to check in a bird book, just look at green heron or greenback heron, and I think you'll find that's what you're seeing.
Okay.
Okay. One other question, too. Would it be possible, last year we thought we saw loons on Buffalo Lake. Is that too far south?
No. Depending on the time of year, when they're moving through, you could see loons on a lake all the way to the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Bob. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about wildlife in your area, maybe not in your area, but just about wildlife, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. And let's go to Glenn in Oneida next. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you very much.
I have two quick questions.
Okay.
One of them is, some muskrats just moved into my shoreline, which doesn't seem to bother me at all, but is there anything that I should be concerned about?
Have you got any daylilies?
No, I don't have any daylilies.
Well, you know, I think the biggest problem that they can cause on a shoreline, if they don't have a nearby wetland or suitable site to build a normal hut-type den, they will bank den. In other words, they'll tunnel back in from below the water line up onto your shoreline or up into a lawn or whatnot. And you probably won't notice that immediately, but eventually, either when they abandon those tunnels or dig them large enough or enough rains hit or whatever, those tunnels will collapse or subside. And especially if it's an area of turf that you're mowing, you're going to end up with your lawnmower or tractor falling into those trenches and eventually end up having to bring in some fill dirt and level things out again. So a lot of people find that bank denning behavior to be a bit obnoxious if they're trying to maintain the area as any kind of a lawn or yard as opposed to natural area.
Okay, yeah, this is pretty natural. It seems to be under some tree trunks or around tree trunks that are on the shoreline.
If you've got good root support and whatnot there to hold the soil, then you're probably not going to notice their presence at all. So I wouldn't worry about it.
Yep.
Okay, one more quick question, if I may.
Sure.
I have a very intelligent animal that's living under an old outhouse that's now used as a shed.
Mm-hmm.
The hole's about 6 inches, and I've tried to catch it in a live trap, which it seems to just rotate until the food comes out, and it reaches in. I think it might be a raccoon, but I'm not sure. Do you have any...
Could be a groundhog.
It could be a groundhog. It could be a raccoon. If you don't smell any odor around the hole, it's probably not a skunk. But I think to avoid the live trap manipulation problem, I'd get a couple of tent stakes and stake the trap down.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then take a twist tie and tie the door open. In other words, just once the door is open, use the twist tie so that the door is disabled, so the trap doesn't work. And put the food in there at the entrance and way back in the trap and give that smart animal 2 or 3 days of thinking, whoa, a feeding station.
Okay.
And they'll get used to going in and out of the trap with no ill effect. The tent stakes will hold it down. And when you're ready to catch it and see that the food is disappearing regularly, bait it up properly, enable the door, and I think you'll get them the first time you do that.
Great. That's a great idea. I'm just curious as to what it is and how intelligent it is. It's very frustrating. But.
Well, I think you've now got a strategy to outwit it, and then you'll know what it is.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. You mentioned the smell of skunks, Scott, but having trapped a lot of groundhogs in my day, I can tell you, they're pretty smelly. I don't know how they stand each other in the rainy season, to be perfectly honest.
I caught some raccoons in the yard in Madison a week or so ago, and oh my God, what a mess! What a mess they made in the trap. So, but
yeah, they're smelly. Anne in Cross Plains, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I'm sure you've had this problem before, but we've had a suicidal cardinal here.
Mm-hmm.
Banging into the windows.
Constantly. And we've had this before, but never to this extent.
Mm-hmm.
Like a week and then it goes away or...
Doing it right now?
2 weeks. Well, no, he's not doing it right now. He met his end. After 2 months, we couldn't take it anymore. He started out in early May and we just started, it's the breeding season and he's protecting his territory. Yeah, but it never stopped.
Mm.
Just never stopped.
Well...
And finally I said, okay, it's time.
Well, you better be a little careful with that because cardinals are
protected.
Federally protected migratory birds. So I understand the frustration level.
Oh, it wasn't that. I mean, we had some illness here, and our stress levels were just going off the roof. We
yeah.
Just,
okay,
you know,
well,
enough was enough.
Okay, so be it. But I guess in the if yet another suicidal cardinal takes up his position, then I think with something that persistent, I'd be covering my windows with bird netting, spaced a few inches.
We tried everything. We even hung curtains outside so they'd blow, and he couldn't see the glass, and everything would work for a day or two.
Well, but if you install the bird netting properly, then there's no physical way the bird can get to the window.
Yeah.
And that will end it completely. But we'll see. Maybe you'll get lucky and another one won't take his place.
Let's hope so. And hope the health situation improves in your household as well, Ann. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Say, Larry, I had another. I'll just offer up an observation I had on a phone call a couple days ago that people might be interested in. I think everyone's seen the occasion of a hawk or a crow flying by and seeing smaller birds dive bombing it, attacking it, and you wonder, boy, why doesn't that hawk just kind of roll over and put an end to that harassment? Anyway, one of our former faculty members was golfing the other day, and his golf party was watching a red-tailed hawk circling over the golf course, and all of a sudden a small bird went up to it and began to attack it, and they were watching. And all of a sudden, one of the guys said, hey, the bird landed on the hawk. And sure enough, the bird was sitting on the back of the hawk. And he said the hawk made a fairly large circle around the golf course with that smaller bird literally sitting on its back, pecking away at it. And it appeared that it was a kingbird, which is a type of flycatcher. But I did a little checking with some fellow ornithologists, and there were others who had observed that. But I've seen birds attack many, many, many times, but never seen the smaller bird actually land on the larger bird.
Yeah, so. That would have been a cool sight. Where's the camera when you need it? Pat in Spring Green, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, talking about seeing things that are kind of unusual. This is a few years ago. I was looking out in the woods, and I noticed some motion. And what it was a rabbit bouncing up and down. And it looked for all the world like the rabbit was on a trampoline, the way it moved.
Mm-hmm.
It bounced up and down, and then it would kick out, and I saw a squirrel. There was a squirrel right around the rabbit, and it went back and forth like that for a while. The rabbit would bounce up and down and kick, and the squirrel would move away. And then finally the squirrel kind of exited the area, but the rabbit followed it, and it continued that behavior. And I've never seen anything like that before.
Hmm. Me neither, although I've seen rabbits jump up in the air when they're startled or when something, when perhaps a squirrel or a chipmunk or something rushes past them in the garden, the rabbit's defense is to leap straight up in the air. And if they were both after the same thing by way of a food source or whatnot, or the squirrel was just being persistent, who knows what was going on. But rabbits will jump and kick like that as a means of getting out of the way of something or defending themselves.
Yeah.
But who knows?
It was, I know, but it was, if you'd seen it, it was so fluid. And the way it was, if you've seen a person on a trampoline,
yeah,
the way they move, and that's the way the rabbit moves. And anyway, it's one of those incidents like the bird in the back of a hawk. I sure wish I'd had a camera.
Yeah, you aren't kidding. Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate the call. Would a rabbit defend its, if it had a nest with little ones?
It's possible.
Possible.
You know, and squirrels, although most people say, oh, a mild-mannered squirrel just looking for an acorn or whatnot, given the opportunity, a gray squirrel will certainly dine on a nestling bird and probably a nestling rabbit if they had the chance.
Martin in West Bend, it's your turn. Hi, Martin.
Hi. The property that we live on, we've been living here for about 10 years. It's a mix of conifers and deciduous trees. And when we first moved here, we had a lot of red squirrels and almost no gray squirrels. Over the course of a couple years, that shifted to all gray squirrels, and we don't see red squirrels anymore. Do they live together in the same area, or is that a territorial thing?
No, they certainly coexist in the same area. If I turn around here and swivel my office chair and look out the window at my feeder, I'll see several color phases of gray squirrels and a half a dozen red squirrels all within 20 feet of each other. They're sometimes aggressive toward each other, and there are all sorts of rumors about the red squirrels being the feistier of the two and driving out the grays. But I think what you're seeing, where you are in West Bend, you're kind of at the southern end of red squirrel range. Their distribution in the state kind of bends down along the Lake Michigan shoreline and inland for a ways, whereas they don't come that far south, more inland in Wisconsin. So I think you've probably just seen over the course of years and a bit of changing habitat some sort of a regression of the distribution of red squirrels maybe a little further north.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Arlene in Verona, your turn now. Hi, Arlene. You know what, Arlene? We're going to hold off on that. We'll get back to you. I'm Larry Mueller with Scott Craven here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in on this 4th of July. And certainly if you want to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Scott, I mentioned VHS, viral hemorrhagic septicemia, which can be found in some of our fish species, and we've talked about it over the last few weeks on the program from time to time, but what's your take on it?
Well, you know, at this point, it's still more of a threat than a reality. There have been some cases identified in fish from the Great Lakes and I think from Lake Winnebago and perhaps other sites by now, but it strikes me as being the fisheries version of chronic wasting disease in terms of its potential impact and the concern and anxiety that it's going to cause or create. But hopefully, the threat won't materialize to the extent that we fear is possible.
No.
I mean, apparently it could be devastating to fish populations,
yeah.
And the fisheries of the sport fishing industry in the state is bigger even than the deer hunting issue in industry. So it's it has potential to cause a lot of problems.
Arlene in Verona, let's go to you now. Arlene, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Yes. I'm wondering if Scott, if you've heard any other sightings about mountain bluebirds. About a week ago, 3 days in succession, I had a very, very light, soft blue bird at my feeder. It was very small, and the only other coloration on it was a light, almost white, near the rump.
I guess that seems like an appropriate description for mountain bluebird, but in answer to your basic question, have I heard of such sightings, the answer is no, but on the other hand, I'm up here in the northern part of the state,
uh-huh,
rather than in my office in Madison, so I'm a little out of the local birding loop there.
Yeah, I understand.
My counsel would be to call the Madison Audubon Society birders hotline and report that and see if anyone responds in kind that they too have seen such a bird or birds, and you know, maybe you can get things down.
It was real exciting. Yeah.
Well, it had to be.
You know, any kind of a rare observation, whether it's bird, mammal, or anything else, is always a neat and exciting thing. But I think when those kinds of rarities occur in the Madison area, they usually get filtered into the network of the Madison Audubon Society birders, and that may help you pin down what you saw or where they might be or if other people have made the same observations.
Yeah, that's what I will do. Incidentally, while I was waiting for you to come back on the line, I was watching a rabbit enjoy my spider plant. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Day.
Yeah. Have a good day, Arlene. Chase that rabbit away, and you'll probably come back. It's John and Black Earth. Your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Let's see. I live in a little farm in Black Earth, right on the edge of a large wetland, and like some of your previous callers, I have all manner of wildlife here. And I have about 3 dozen chickens. And to make sure that I always have 3 dozen chickens, I have a 5-foot fence, 1-inch mesh, and then net over the top to keep the red-tailed hawks out, and I have the fence electrified.
Wow.
So
sounds
that
like an armored chicken facility.
Armored chicken farm.
Okay.
The problem I have is I am an amateur herpetologist, and I enjoy all the snakes that live around here. There's quite a few, and there's quite a few in my barn.
Mm-hmm.
And last summer I lost 3 large female rat snakes that electrocuted themselves on my fence. Now, these aren't, of course, big enough to mess with the adult chickens, so I'm thinking, well, if I put a larger mesh in that will allow the snake to go through without trying to climb up the fence and getting zapped. But my question is, I know I have mink and everything else here, but if I use a larger mesh, weasels could be an issue.
I wouldn't change your chicken operation at all. It sounds like that's working for you, and if you go to larger mesh, then you do risk problems from weasels and mink, which are weasels too. But rather than that, I would put up some other type of perimeter barrier that might keep the snakes away from the main fence entirely.
Hmm.
And that could be a much lower fence with an outward bending flange or angle on the top. If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So essentially it's L-shaped with the vertical surface being the longer. And then something, so even if the snakes start up it, they can't go any further. And actually you might not even have to use a wire material. You might get away with erosion control barrier, this black, you know, maybe 2-foot wide heavy plastic that you'll see around construction sites to slow down water movement. Either that or a band of sheet metal or flashing or anything smooth like that that you can find. I mean, even plastic like Visqueen vapor barrier or something like that would probably work if you trench it in a couple inches and then just run it up a couple of feet. I think that will stop the snakes completely.
So you would put it at an angle outward? Is that what you
think? I think you could go up vertically, but then if you use some type of a post that allows you to bend it a little bit, that has a little flexibility,
okay,
then just bend it outward a bit at the top. Especially if it's something the snakes can get a grip on and climb, the angle's going to be more important. If it's something they can't climb at all because it's smooth or slippery, then a couple of feet, even straight up, would probably eliminate the snakes.
Well, terrific. I appreciate the idea.
All right. Thanks, John.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. William, and speaking of luck, William in Luck, Wisconsin. Hi, William.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about moose in the state of Wisconsin. Recently, well, not so recently, I was traveling up to Solon Springs, Wisconsin, and I took a short road through the Empire Swamp up there, and I believe I saw a moose. And I'm a farm kid. I would be able to recognize this. I thought it was a mule to begin with, but I believe I saw a moose.
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, moose are big enough, and with those big old blubbery noses, they're pretty distinctive.
Yes.
Solon Springs is a little west where most of the moose sightings have occurred in recent years. It's animals that have moved over into northeastern Wisconsin, primarily from a source population in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I haven't seen much information for the past couple of years, but I think it was in 2002 in the summer when the first record of a moose calf in the state in many, many decades occurred, again in northeastern Wisconsin. And at that time, I heard the wildlife managers talking about the fact, you know, there might be a dozen to 15 animals, primarily, again, in the northeastern part of the state. But a moose is a big animal, and they can cover a lot of ground. So the fact that one strayed that far west, or may have even come in from from a different direction, from Minnesota, for example, is all possible.
Well, I have heard of other people talking about moose up there, too. I know of one hunter that claims he saw a bull up there. This is probably 3 years ago.
Yeah? Well, if you're, you know, I don't see any reason to doubt the sightings, and it's certainly possible. Most of the moose, the cougar, the other large unusual mammal sightings are tracked at the DNR office in Park Falls, and I think if you either wanted to contact the local wildlife manager for the Empire Swamp area, either they might get in touch with the folks at Park Falls who track this kind of thing, or they may know themselves what's been going on there as far as sightings or the presence of a moose. I think that's the way to kind of pin it down.
Yep. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Mike in Wausau. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hey, my first question is on evolution. How much longer before deer get better at not standing in the middle of the road at night?
Well, there's a selective force going on. The ones that tend to stand there in the middle of the road get weeded out of the population, so it's Darwin's theory at work.
That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping maybe a couple more generations they'll start doing that left, because I drive so much at night and I'm tired of having to swerve around them.
And since turnabout is fair play, Mike, and you live in Wausau and you mentioned roads, do you know if there are any plans to ever finish the highway construction around Wausau?
That's a good question.
I think about the same time the deer figure out, okay, not standing in the middle of the road. So. Actually, my question is about robins, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I had a shrub in front of my house that last year a robin nest went into. It was kind of a short one, only about 4 feet off the ground,
mm-hmm,
so I could stare right into it. And this year they came and they put a nest right on top of the old one. I'm just wondering if that's the same offspring, and are they just going to continue to do that? Because now the thing's about, I don't know, 6 inches tall and kind of leaning on the shrubs, and I'm wondering if I can just remove the old two nests, or is that going to screw up their...
I think the robins, as well as many birds, are very faithful to the home territory, even the same shrub, same nest box, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the exact same pair or perhaps some of their offspring, doesn't really matter. They are likely to return, and after the nesting effort is over with for the year and those birds have moved on, I think it's the site that they're more interested in than the former nest. So if you view the architecture to be faulty and remove it, they'll start over again next spring.
Great. It's beautiful watching them build it, too. Amazing how they put a little mud floor in it, and it's just really cool watching them do that.
It sure is. They're
pretty good at it.
Great. Well, thank you for your...
You bet.
Yep. Thanks, Mike. And Dan in New London, your turn now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was calling about the comment for the birds that were sighted near Montello, wondering if they were maybe cormorants instead of green herons.
Yeah, that's a good thought, especially since he thought they were only slightly smaller than a great blue heron. Excellent thought. I just drew a blank on the cormorants, but they are black. They do have the long, pointy, and with the orange throat sac, it would appear to be part of the bill, and they would sit in a tree. They would be in a group, probably more of a group than green herons would be.
Right.
So I think, Dan, you've caught me on this. I'm going to go with your speculation of cormorants.
Okay, I had another comment. I was bow hunting my in-law's farm in northern Waupaca County last year, and I went into the swamp looking for a deer that I shot, and I found a carcass of another deer that the rib cage and backbone were picked clean, and the skin was pulled off and laid on the side, almost like folded up.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 days later, an acquaintance of mine's brother was hunting on the property line and saw, he called it a black panther. He said, unmistakable, long tail, and he watched it for about 10 minutes, about 50 yards away. And I heard weird noises in the swamp that night when I found that carcass, and I was just...
Well, that's going to keep you out of that swamp.
Yeah. I was a little nervous.
I don't think you have a great deal to be nervous about, and I'm not sure what was seen. The description seems obvious enough, but was your concern linking that animal to the carcass you found?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's possible, too, but... There are many, especially during the deer season, deer carcasses are a pretty common sight on the landscape, and there are virtually everything in the woods will work on a deer carcass to the point that it's picked clean or virtually disappears in an amazingly short period of time. Our students have been working down in the chronic wasting disease area monitoring deer carcasses with cameras to determine how long they persist in the woods and what feeds on them. You would be amazed at how many different animals, from mice and chickadees and shrews up to hawks and eagles and everything else in the woods, works that carcass over until it vanishes in as short as perhaps a week or two.
Well, it seems strange how the skin was pulled off and almost folded up along the side,
well,
rather than shredded.
Yeah, that suggests a larger animal that had enough strength to do that, but... That's, you know, that's hard to say. There's
yeah.
also the possibility that somebody else hunting the swamp pulled the skin off to take the back straps or the, you know, the rounds or whatever, and just left the rest of it there to be picked clean. So I can't tell you for sure what happened there, Dan. And I think although it's possible what was seen by, was it your brother or brother-in-law? Or, well, anyway,
yeah.
what was seen was related to the carcasses, kind of a stretch.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for calling. Mary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I would like to ask about three questions concerning what I call a muskrat house.
Okay.
Is it anchored? And what is the prime material they use? And how deep does it float, or is it in shallow water?
Muskrats generally inhabit shallow water. The house, there are several structures they may build. The hut or house that they actually make a pile of vegetation, usually cattail roots and tubers and stems and so forth, they may create a mound of this material and then hollow out a living chamber within the center of that mound. So it's firmly piled on the bottom, so however deep the water is, that's how far down that hut or house extends. But they also create smaller piles of vegetation that are called feeding piles that they just simply use as a platform to eat or sit there and feed on. So you could be seeing both things, but the house itself is a solid structure firmly embedded on the bottom, and one common building material is cattails, but they'll use whatever is available.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Michelle in Middleton, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Earlier this spring, I saw a flying squirrel a bunch of times in front of our house on a birch tree. And I'm wondering, is that unusual? And I haven't seen the flying squirrel since, so I wonder what happened to it.
Well, it's not unusual. We had a caller earlier talking about their first encounter with flying squirrels, too. They're really quite common over most of the state. But because they're so strictly nocturnal, it's very unusual to see one out during the day. You do occasionally, and that may be what you saw, and the squirrels may very well still be there, but you're just not seeing them because they're active only at night. If it was a single individual, and this was a few months ago, most of these small mammals have a fairly high mortality rate, or conversely, a low survival rate. So it's possible that something tragic befell that squirrel and it's simply gone. But I think it's more likely that they're still around and you're just not seeing them at that time of day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Mike in Seneca, your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi, Larry. I've got a kind of a unusual problem to me. Well, it's not a problem, but something happened with a robin nest and Scott kind of touched on it. I had a robin build a new nest on a downspout coming off of a shed, and it's about chest, a little about to your neck high.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got four cats. It's a bad spot, and she had a brood in there that was, she laid four eggs, they hatched, the birds disappeared, and then she laid, within a course of like 3 weeks to a month, she laid four more. And they hatched, and now yesterday they disappeared. And I'm wondering when they leave the nest. Well, first of all, is that unusual circumstance using the nest there? Should I leave the nest? And then secondly, do you think the cats got them? Or when they leave the nest, can they fly enough to get a ways away? That's what I was wondering. Otherwise,
okay.
Well, first of all, it sounds like a pretty iffy nest site selection to begin with. But birds will do what they think is in their best interest, but if the bird may not have counted on the cat situation. So avoiding talking about the cats for a moment, because I don't want to open that can of worms, I would just suggest that might be the spot that if the birds are persistent in the future, that you might want to, you know, put a piece of plastic over, just drape a piece of plastic over that or a little bird netting so that they have to find an alternative site. Or you could go up close to the downspout and actually attach a robin nesting platform to the side of the house up a little higher and away from the reach of the cats. The fact that they have a secure nesting platform, however, doesn't mean that the young, when they first leave the nest, they may be able to flutter a bit, but they're certainly going to spend some time on the ground. And if there are a number of marauding cats in the area, the likelihood that those young robins are going to make it for very long is not high. So I think it's a combination of a lousy choice of a nest site, the presence of the cats, and who knows what else. But yeah. I guess I'd discourage them from nesting there in the future.
Thanks, Mike. Diane and Mercer, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have questions about blastomycosis.
Yeah.
We live on the turtle flambeau, and there's been cases of it up here. And I was wondering, do the native animals get it?
I don't think so. One of the more common names for blasto is beaver fever, and if you go to some of the public health websites and enter blasto, you'll come up with some pretty nice fact sheets on what causes it, what to do about it, how people are at risk, and so forth. It's often associated with beaver dams and lodges, and people that are working around such sites or ripping out a beaver dam are often potentially exposed, but I've heard of dogs also coming down with it, simply swimming in a flowage, for example, where the organism may be present. So it's not something, though, that we hear a lot about as being a threat to native wildlife populations. It's more of a human health risk and potentially pets. But
is there a time of year?
Pardon me?
Is there a time of year where
I think it's a warm season issue primarily.
Yeah, although I contracted it during a warm deer hunting season one year.
Ah, well, so at least open water season, if nothing else. But again, I've seen some really nice fact sheets on the public health websites if you just enter, or just enter blasto on a computer on a Google search, and you'll come up with more information than you ever wanted.
Would I be able to ask a question about bats?
Sure, I think, if we have time.
Yeah, we got time.
Oh, okay.
Got about a minute.
I have a very large bat house. It's got about 200 bats in it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last 3 years, around this week, around the 4th of July, some of the babies fall out, young bats. It's little brown bats.
Right.
And we were thinking now that maybe it gets so hot and their sizes are larger that it's so crowded in there, they kind of push each other out.
That's possible. If the temperature regime was poor, I don't think the bats would select that as a nursery colony. It's kind of unusual for them to have a nursery colony in a bat house at all. But if they're in there and most are surviving, that's probably all you can hope for. In a colony of 200 individuals, they have one pup per female. I would expect normal attrition means that, you know, several dozen of those young either are going to fall out, die from other causes, and something happens to the female, the young one then perishes. There's all those young bats can't possibly survive. All the young bats in any roost can't possibly survive. So I think what you're observing is natural attrition, and I wouldn't be too concerned about it.
Thanks, Diane, for calling. Scott, happy 4th.
Happy 4th, Larry. Enjoy the rest of the day. And all the listeners, I'm going to go jump in the lake now.
Well, I'm going to be in the lake later on, too. Thanks for being with us, Scott. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. You'll be back the first Wednesday of next month, and we'll do this all over again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the Woodlanders Gathering, an advocate for it with Dan Mack, and then we'll take a look at Silent Sports Magazine. Stay with us.